Muffin Talk. Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, Bible studies, or the Catholic Church, or interfaith dialogue. Today I have invited Dr. Christopher Longhurst to a Zoom recording for a broadcast. Chris, a warm welcome and hi to my radio program.
Haere mai. Thank you, Beate. It's lovely to be here with you again.
Dr. Christopher Longhurst is a New Zealander who has spent many years abroad, and he returned to Aotearoa, New Zealand after his academic studies in theology and gaining experience in Europe and Northern Africa. In Rome, Italy, he was then an operatore didattico, an educational instructor for the scientific and administrative management of the Vatican Museums. And in Ifrane, Morocco, he served as assistant professor of philosophy and religious studies at Al Akwan University. Back in New Zealand, he is a lecturer at the Kupinga Theological College of Aotearoa, New Zealand, and is actively involved in interreligious dialogue and interfaith work. Chris, can you tell us more about your role in Italy as operatore didattico in the Vatican Museums? What does that mean?
It's the Italian word, literally operatore didattico, a didactic operator. But I guess it translates more regarding its meaning into like a docent. You know, in Europe, academics who work outside of universities, in basilicas and museums, are referred to as docente, docents is the English word for it. So we were basically the docents of the Vatican Museums. You know, I used to kid with my colleagues that we were like glorified tour guides, because granted there were tour guides, but there was this group of specialists in certain fields. And they were the teaching operators, the operatore didattico, because we did have a different license. So we were a little more academic and we were responsible for presenting the content of the Vatican Museums in a more educational way rather than just as a tour guide. So my specialization, of course, was in theological aesthetics or more specifically the church's patrimony of the arts. So it wasn't just about religious art, but it was, art that had been collected by the Vatican Museums to do with, the excavations of ancient Rome by Renaissance popes who were digging up Rome to find those works of antiquity that inspired the Renaissance. Pope Julius II, for example, one of the first popes to excavate Rome, finding things like the Laocoon in Flamini's backyard. You know, these inspired artists like Michelangelo and Raphael study. And the popes had a lot of pagan art on display as well. So we were just a group, about 16 specialists in our own fields, art history, Roman history, church history, who would give tours.
I'm glad that you mentioned the art and the popes, because sometimes people forget how much the popes were contributing to the art in Europe. And popes and bishops, there were so many who were really interested in art and who supported artists.
Absolutely, absolutely. The papacy, especially the Renaissance papacy and the Baroque popes, use the artists to promote the religion. Art is a very important means to promote any political, religious ideology. So it was quite brilliant of the popes to use the arts to advertise their own, not only the patrimony of the arts, but also their own wealth. And people like that. We have to be honest. The fact that the popes were using the artists to decorate public space, beautiful Renaissance piazzas with fountains, the people loved that. We're very grateful for the artistic patrimony of the popes, but not just the popes, the Medici family, who incidentally produced three or four popes anyway. But I think one of the beautiful things about the church's patrimony of the arts is that it was a promotion of culture, at least at that time too. We tend to emphasize more the religious side of papal rule. That wasn't so important back in the Renaissance, of course. The Renaissance was a move away, actually, from religious rule, more to civic rule.
And also, it did tell the stories the way that the bishops or popes interpreted them. And I think that's also an important point, because that when you talk about Renaissance, that was just the time when the printing press was introduced. So they were still promoting their interpretation via pictures mainly.
But yes and no, because when you have free thinkers or radical minds like Michelangelo, you know, that's an interesting issue you raise, because how much of it was his own doing? You know, we do have that legitimate artistic license. He was told what to do, and certainly, though, didn't follow the instructions of the... so this was also a time of freedom for the artists too. Granted, you know, the patrons liked to pretend that they were in charge, and to a certain degree they were, but when you had people like Caravaggio or Michelangelo, they often ignored their contracts and went off and did what they wanted anyway. So perhaps we can look also celebrate the Renaissance as that freedom of artistic license to be more expressive, to move away from religion as well. You know, some of the artworks were very sexy, and that was controversial too. You know, works by Botticelli at the time, see standing nudes, Venus, yeah. And even lying down.
Venus in the shell, yeah.
They're very sexy, which led to beauty, which led to love. So a lot of it was a great form of, not propaganda, but advertising, yeah. Advertising for the aristocracy of Italy.
We've already touched a bit on the Renaissance, and currently Auckland is hosting an exhibition that might make you feel a little bit like you are in Europe for a while. The exhibition is called Renaissance, the Age of Genius, and it's happening at Auckland's Aotea Centre, and it started a few days ago and will run until the 29th of January. What will be your role in this exhibition?
I'm leading what they're calling the VIP tours, which is an after-hours visit to the exhibit, which will commence with an introduction by me, a lecture to talk about what will be displayed in the exhibit and how it will be displayed. And then I'm there to guide the participants through the artworks, because it's quite a unique kind of exhibit. It's not a traditional standing in front of an artwork. It's more like a movie, actually, where many of these masterpieces we talk about the Age of Genius. These are genius. These are not artists who were just painters. These are philosophers and scientists and medics who are using art to express the beauty of nature, the realism of floral and animal forms. So, you know, these are scientists. These are great thinkers and intellectuals that are using art. Raphael puts himself among the great philosophers as an artist. So this exhibit is very deep, and it's much more than just the art, because what you'll see is the artworks in a way come to life. And in a sense, this is extraordinary, because it's kind of like the end sum of what the Renaissance artist would have wanted you to experience, because these artworks are very, very real.
How do they do it technically?
Yeah, it's a high-tech motion production of the artworks from the floor to the ceiling, so larger than life, that move. So, for example, you get to see the Mona Lisa. We take the Mona Lisa. The Mona Lisa is quite small when you see the image in real life, and you see it from a distance. So this exhibit will allow us to zoom in to actually see the brushstrokes on the painting and the detail and zoom in on the face, zoom in on the smile, for example. Then it will zoom in on the background and zoom out and even allow you to see the form of the chair that she's sitting on. And other works, for example, in Botticelli's two masterworks, the Birth of Venus and Primavera, you know, you'll see Flora, the nymph of spring, dropping the flowers. So the flowers move, the flowers fall out of the basket. So the artworks come to life. So in a way, the exhibit is helping the participant to participate in the artwork, which is what the Renaissance artists would have wanted you to do. But we've lost that learned understanding of what it was to participate in the Renaissance artwork. You know, Michelangelo's works, he's not wanting you to stand back and say, oh, what a wonderful work of art, and kind of like analyze the perspective and the harmony and the balance. He's wanting you to kind of come in and participate in the event. Renaissance art is of its time and it's real, so therefore it's real for us today when we see it. You know, who is she looking at? Where is the movement going? If the central figure in a Renaissance work of art is not directly looking at you, then you want to look at what he or she is looking at, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not just about the central figures as well. There's a lot of detail in Renaissance art in the background too. So, for example, perspective as well. The perspective will come to life. So it's an animation with high technology, motion pictures, audio visual, that allows you to kind of like participate in the artworks as each sequence of artists' masterpieces unfolds throughout the display.
I think it's interesting that you say come to life, because we're talking about Renaissance, which means, if you translate literally, new birth. And in an article in the New Zealand Herald, you connected Renaissance, this new birth, a time of new birth or rediscovery of the classical antiquity, with the Maori concept of kamua kamuri. Where yes. Did you see this connection, the connections?
Sure. Kamua kamuri is te reo for walking backwards into the future. So it's about looking back onto the past to see where we're going into the future. So to plan our future, to make that the best it can be, then we can learn from what's gone before us, but we can learn from the wisdom of the past. And that's what Renaissance masters did and their patrons did. That was a time of discovering the wisdom of the Greco-Roman civilizations, the beauty of a public space in the Roman concept. When you look at Renaissance buildings today, Renaissance spaces, for example, they're really a revitalization of that sense of civic equality in the public Roman space. The Roman Forum, for example. So the Dark Ages had lost that. That medieval period from the fall of Rome up until this period, that was all lost. And the literature as well, the works of Plato and Aristotle and Ptolemy, and even the Roman orators, they were being read now for the first time since they had been written and lost. You know, people like Marsilio Ficino, who was the head of the Florentine Academy, was sending his students up into Benedictine monasteries in Germany, where they were discovering this literature again, which is being read again, and is focusing on which is what the Romans did, the dignity of the human person. Therefore, there's a move away from the theocentricity of the medieval to the kind of like the homocentricity, the human-centeredness. So that's all coming to life again. So it must have been quite exciting for the people to now, you know, have equality even. I have to be careful what I'm saying here, of course, because in a sense I'm generalizing. And even though in that article I did mention about how an entire continent ended up going back to the ideals of past civilizations, it kind of wasn't like that. But that's how we see it today. You know, the Renaissance is a very complex period too, from the 1300s to the 1600s. But most of the historians will tell us today, when based on the evidence that they can garner, that most of the people living at that time wouldn't have experienced this Renaissance. It comes later. You know, Vasari, Giorgio Vasari, who's a historian of the time, he simply talks about the rinascita, the Italian word for, as you said, the new birth, or the rebirth, to describe this return to ancient literature. That Whakatauke, that Māori Whakatauke, sums that up quite well, which is very important for us, I think, in New Zealand, because that implies that Māori culture, the Māori tradition, never really lost that idea of moving forward by benefiting what had gone before us in the past. therefore the past being present and helping us to pave a better way for the future. That's how I understand kamua, kamuri, walking backwards into the future. So I see myself standing in the front of the whare, looking at the past as I move into the future with my back toward the future, therefore benefiting from everything that's gone before me. So the past is very much alive, but we're not stuck in the past. We're using the wisdom from the past to pave a way for the future. And that's really important for today, because remember, one of the key ideas of the Renaissance was the unification of science and history and art and religion, where the liberal arts was about studying all of this to understand everything in its totality and its completeness. And we seem to have lost that today. In my experience, we don't so much talk about the liberal arts or the humanities today, and I'm not even quite sure where we study them in New Zealand. We're in an age, I think, on the brink of having to make a decision. Do we benefit from what's gone before us, or do we blindly just go ahead doing things differently? Because, I mean, look at our cityscapes today. When we compare those to the Renaissance, I mean, they're quite ugly, I would say, because we don't have that unification of knowledge, that universare, that versare, that turning towards the orni, the oneness of our being human, of our being a humanity, of being a united civilization, which is what the Renaissance was too. It was more of a unification.
Also, maybe we'll also have to think of the times of the Renaissance, the beginning of the Renaissance. You had a beginning of the 16th century. There was the time when 1492 or so, when America was discovered, you saw that there were other worlds. It was, whereas in the Middle Ages, you had a lot of diseases and a lot of wars. Then people could go out and escape. And at the same time, the printing press was discovered, and people started to criticize powerful people. In Germany, you had the Farmers' Wars, which were against the church, but also against any kind of sort of not slavery, but kind of belonging to the nobility or to the landowner and having no other rights. So all of this longing for freedom, I think that's part of this being born again in that Renaissance. And at the same time, people kept the culture. And to me, the culture is what you say, what you had in the past. So you have the culture in the back, but you're moving forward. You're having your eyes open.
Sure. And, you know, even though we often think of the Renaissance as great works of art, going back to that idea of the exhibit, the Age of Genius, it was what's behind these artworks that allowed them, that contributed to them being the best kind of artworks at the time, which by best it was the most realistic. So those skills to produce artworks that had the skills of physiognomy behind them, for example, where you kind of could know about the personality of the person you were looking at based on the way he or she's being presented, you know, that required a certain skill. The Renaissance changed the way people saw and understood the world, which led to those great discoveries, led to making more money to trade, to banking, to loaning, to expeditions that led to scientific industrial revolution as well, that came out of that 16th century's movement into the Baroque.
What you said with the exhibition, that you have art that is more than 500 years old, and then you have high technology, high tech methods to bring it into life today. That's another Renaissance by itself.
Indeed, absolutely. And, I think you were talking about the printing press and translating these texts to make them readable. In the Renaissance, that concept today is so media. So we're living in a digital age by which there's so much information and, it's causing us to, it's forcing us to change. And I think, again, we're on the brink of a massive change, a Renaissance in a way. And, At the same time, here in New Zealand, we have this revitalization of traditional Māori knowledge, which is part of the return to holding on to the wisdom of the past as well, which of course Māori always had. However, because of other forces, that wasn't shared with, you know, with people who came into this country, didn't benefit from that wisdom as well. So there are so many more branches of knowledge and fields of study that are behind what becomes, in the end, the promotion of the Renaissance through the artwork. It just shows you the power of art and the importance of art too. But it's because the object of art is beauty. And even though it focuses on the visual arts, remember sculpture and architecture are visual arts too. And architecture becomes the manifestation of the visual in public space. And that was also a very important thing about the Renaissance as well, the public space through architecture. But then it spills into a culture of life as well, Renaissance dress, Renaissance costume.
For the exhibition artwork, is that mainly Italian artwork or also French or other European artwork?
Indeed, no, that's a good point. There are 10 artists, and there's a sequence of their artworks, and it's not chronological, though, if you look at the dates of the artists. There are 7 who are Italian, and there are 2 Germans, and there is a Dutch artist. The exhibit also looks at how the Northern Renaissance, the German and Dutch Renaissance, was similar and different to the Italian Renaissance. But remember, Italy didn't exist at the time, so we're talking about the Republic of Florence, and that's where it started. It started in Florence, but it wasn't because of the artists just happened to be in Florence. It's because the money and the trade. You had the Medicis were bankers. They were rich, and they had certain monopolies over trading with the Ottomans. So the importance about the money was that it wasn't kept for themselves. It wasn't kept for the Medici family. The brilliant idea of Cosimo de' Medici and his grandson, Lorenzo the Magnificent, Lorenzo de' Medici, was to use this money to create a better society for their own people. That's what really the Renaissance was. So, it was the rebirth of a cultural movement financed by bankers and through trade and learning. So I think that's an important point to make.
In Germany, you also had the Fuggers at the time, so you also had rich bankers. But, of course, Italy and especially Florence, they were at strategically very important points, and you could reach them from the water much easier. Whereas if you wanted to go to Germany, you would have to cross the Alps.
Right. Well, what I wanted to mention was the artists, who they were. We begin in the Republic of Florence with Botticelli, of course. Well, actually, the exhibit begins with Giotto, because Giotto is that proto-Renaissance master who moves the medieval into the Renaissance by looking at perspective for the first time, where in Giotto's works you very clearly have a foreground and a background. The exhibit begins with Giotto, and it moves through some of his religious themes into the works of Botticelli, who's from the Republic of Florence. He's the first artist to bring ancient myth and allegory into the arts of the time as well. They're very sensuous. They're still religious, but there's some mythology there in Botticelli's works. And then, of course, Leonardo da Vinci, who's from the Republic of Florence as well, the founder of the High Renaissance style. And by High Renaissance, for me, there's nothing different from the proto-Renaissance through up into the high and to the late Renaissance. It's just that it gets better. And by better, it's more idealistic. It's more perfected, and it's more real as well. And that might seem like a contradiction, but it's not. The real and the ideal coexist in the Renaissance, and that's what makes the Renaissance important too, because it's about being the best kind of person, but nevertheless being a real person. We look at the highlights of Leonardo da Vinci's works, of course, the Mona Lisa, the beautiful portrait of Ginevra di Benci, and his women. But it also moves into his anatomy as well, where we look at his study of, in the fields of science, and how he, had many sketches of the human form, even the development of the fetus in the womb. So that comes alive in the exhibit. And of course, he was one of the greatest inventors in history. So there's the representations of the plane and the helicopter and those flying machines. They come to life in the exhibit as well. And again, you see the human emotion in some of the faces, where the exhibit will zoom in to see the shouting of a flawless accuracy of a face that's shouting and in pain and stress and the forehead, and the opposite as well, where the very delicate control of emotion in Leonardo da Vinci's works as well. They're moving, of course, into Michelangelo, Republic of Florence, of course, with his highlights in the Sistine Chapel, then into Raphael, who's of the Umbrian school of Italy, looking at his masterpieces, the school of Athens, and his beautiful, flawless Madonnas, the Madonna of the Sistine Madonna, the Madonna of the Prato. So the exhibit presents a lot really quickly. It's quite intense. Then it moves from Raphael into Caravaggio, who's late Renaissance, the late Italian Renaissance. You look at some of his works like the Medusa, where the snakes in the head of Medusa come to life, they're real, they move, you'll see them move. And then Titian, the seventh artist is Titian, and as we know, Titian's from the Republic of Venice, the Venetian school, very famous for his portraits and the emotion and the realism in the portraits. You'll see the shadow under the eyes and the softness of the flesh and the veins and the blood rushing through them and in a painting. We might take this for granted today, but this is quite revolutionary and quite controversial to see the real people painted, celebrating them. And women too, women who are semi-nude with their busts showing, very sensuous portraits by Titian that influenced the development of other northern artists as well.
It sounds really interesting. I think we put the 10 artists on the website so that people can read it, because we are running out of time. Imagine, the time flies. So thank you so much for all this information. And we'll put some more information on my website. And there's something in your article also, so we can motivate the listeners to read the article. So what's coming up at Titi Pounamu Study in Joy? Well, we'll start in February with two sessions on Genesis and the creation story. We haven't fixed the date yet, but one session will be about the scriptural background of Genesis and the creation story, and the other session will combine the creation story with art and an interfaith perspective. And we'll also run a new series with the title Focus on Target, Draw Fresh Momentum. This is a series that consists of 4 hourly sessions starting on Wednesday, the 15th of February, and then 4 consecutive Wednesdays. We'll have a facilitator who will help to understand the movement towards life's focal point. These sessions will be interesting for anybody, irrespective of religion. For more information and registration, please see my website at www.studyjoy.nz. And we'll also put some more information about Chris and about the Renaissance painters on the website. Kia kaha, keep safe, and thank you so much, Chris, for this interview.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Beate. Matewa.